Hi, I'm Dr. Boyce Watkins from Your Black World. This is a very, very important week. This week, President Barack Obama is going to take a visit to the El Reno Federal Correction Institution in Oklahoma. And he is the first sitting president to ever visit a federal prison, which many see as kind of a landmark opportunity to really address the mass incarceration epidemic and what it's done to our society, what it's done particularly to our community, etc. And a person that I just had to talk to about this is a man that for whom I have tremendous respect. He's a veteran of this mass incarceration epidemic. His name is Mr. Darryl Padgett, and Darryl's going to tell you his story. But before we get to all of this, I want to ask Mr. Padgett, how you doing today, brother?
I'm doing well, Dr. Watkins. How about yourself?
I'm doing really well, really well. Now, you had a compelling story that really got my attention. You've written a lot of articles, you know, on our platform. You did, if I'm not mistaken, were sentenced to 40 years for very minor nonviolent drug possession, and you were able to get the sentence cut to 20. But even 20 years is entirely too much. Can you tell us about what happened, what you were sentenced for, and all that stuff, so people kind of know the background?
Yes, I had sold a gram of crack cocaine to an undercover informant. It was a sting operation. 1 gram. The federal government took the case, began prosecution. I proceeded to trial, and ultimately I was convicted and sentenced to 37.5 years in prison. During my incarceration, I started studying the law. And after 20 years of service, I was able to get a reduction in my sentence. And thereafter, I was able to get another reduction in my sentence. And ultimately, I was released from federal prison in 2012.
Wow. Okay. So for selling 1 gram of crack to an undercover officer, you were given 37 and a half years in prison. Now, that number, 37 and a half, is a curious number for me. Why did they say 37 and a half, not 37, not 38? Were they following some sort of guideline when they did this, or was this the judge's discretion? I mean, how did that work out?
Yeah, it was the judge's discretion within the guideline. When I was sentenced, the guidelines were mandatory. Subsequently, the Supreme Court made the guidelines advisory, but my sentence, it wasn't a mandatory minimum, it was a guideline sentence, but the guidelines functions were mandatory. So the sentence was actually based upon testimony of witnesses, what witnesses had said without having any real physical evidence. The only real physical evidence in my case was the gram of crack cocaine that I had sold. Everything else was based upon witness testimony, and they received a reduction in their sentence, and even one individual, he escaped prison. He wasn't prosecuted, let me say it like that. But yes, that's how it unfolded.
Wow. So before we get into more of the broader issue, I want to ask more about you. First of all, how old were you when they gave you this sentence?
I had just turned 26.
Okay. So you're a 26-year-old man, your life is just beginning. And it's amazing that you even said you're 26, because you look young. You don't even look over, if you told me you're 39 now, I'd believe you. So what goes through your mind, when you're 26 years old, your life is just starting, and somebody's just told you that you're going to get almost 40 years in prison. That at that time, that means you're expected to be out at what, the age of 60, well, almost 66, 63, 64 years old, something like that. How does that make you feel? What goes through your mind when that happens to you?
Well, when it happened, I didn't believe it. I didn't think it was going to hold up. And even before I was sentenced, and my attorney had told me that, I was facing a life sentence. I could actually be sentenced to life in prison. And I couldn't understand that. Furthermore, I didn't believe it. And it was just something that was difficult for me to accept. Nonetheless, I knew that my freedom, if I were to gain my freedom, it was going to depend on me and not an attorney or nobody else. I had lost faith in the system. So that's when I began hitting the books every day for 20 years. And ultimately, I was able to gain my freedom. But it was something that I could not understand, and I could not believe that for 1 gram of crack cocaine, that my case was going to proceed into a life sentence, that I would be placed, that I could have been placed in prison until death.
So, just so we know the detail on this, was there any parole? Did they say, okay, you got to do so many years before you can go up for parole? What did they say about parole when they gave you the sentence?
Under federal law, there's no parole. If you get a life sentence, you would die in prison. There's a good time. You get 54 days a year, good time if you're if you don't violate any policies or violate any regulations. You get 54 days a year on each year. But still, that's a lot of time to serve for a nonviolent offense.
So, one thing I want to ask before we get into the politics of everything, because I think that your personal story is very important. I think people should hear this. And also, I can personally say I was very impressed with your degree of education and intelligence. I mean, I always tell people I know a lot of folks who went to school, but I know a real scholar when I see one. And when I talk to two individuals that I think about that are veterans of the system, yourself and Yurima Karama. Both of you guys have intellect levels that exceed most of the PhDs that I know. And I know what it's from. It's from all the books you read during your time away. Tell me about, in terms of your family, what impact did this have on your family? How did they cope with what you were going through?
It was very traumatic to my parents and to my wife and everyone in my family. I was married when I was incarcerated, and I was still married to the same woman. I am still married to the same woman, and upon my release, she was there waiting on me. But nonetheless, it was difficult for her. It was hard for her. I lost my mom while I was incarcerated. And one thing that she always asks is that you didn't kill anyone. When are you going to come home? But I made it.
So your wife, you gotta let me take my time to ask the questions, man, because I'm connecting with what you're describing here. So your wife, you were married when you went away, and you said she was waiting for you when you came out of the walls of their penitentiary. Really?
Yes,
Wow.
20 years.
Wow. That's an amazing woman. An amazing woman. Wow. Okay. So let's get into this, man, because I like I said, I'm affected by this, but I'm not even gonna hide it, man. It's just hearing your story, connecting to it, black man to black man. It's hard to hear this without feeling emotional. I mean, I think anybody that hears this and doesn't have a reaction is out of their mind. So tell me about this. One of the things that I was also impressed by is the fact that you spent the years studying, hitting the books. You were able to get your sentence reduced significantly, to the point where you were able to begin your new life. But once you got out, you didn't just kind of move on. You actually continuously advocated for the individuals that were left behind in the system, many of whom were nonviolent offenders, who had good behavior, who deserve to have their sentences commuted or shortened so that they can get out. Tell me about that. What's happening that's making it so difficult for nonviolent drug offenders to get a second chance in our society? What's kind of going on here legally that's stopping this from occurring?
Well, actually, it has become a political issue. Politicians, they're playing with prisoners' lives. In 2012, well, 2010, Congress had changed or passed the Fair Sentencing Act. That reduced crack cocaine law, the 100-to-1 disparity in the crack cocaine sentences. But nonetheless, although it reduced the crack cocaine disparity, prisoners that was already serving a mandatory minimum sentence could not be released. They had to stay in prison. But I was serving a guideline sentence for crack cocaine, and it was retroactive, and I was able to get out of prison. But somebody that had done the same thing that I had done, but was sentenced under a mandatory minimum statutory provision, still crack cocaine, they're still in prison today. They can't get out.
So you mean to tell me that there are lots of nonviolent offenders, some of whom may have even, this might have even been their first offense in some cases, who've had good behavior, who've been in prison well over 1, 2, maybe even 3 decades, who still can't get out despite the fact that the crack to powder disparity has been reduced?
Correct.
Interesting.
Because it isn't retroactive. The guidelines, the crack cocaine guidelines are retroactive. The statutory provision for selling crack cocaine is not retroactive. I don't understand the logic. I understand the law, but I don't understand the logic of this. There's really no difference. And well, the only difference is that Congress did not include in the legislation a provision that said that the change in crack cocaine sentences would be retroactive. The Sentencing Commission had that authority to do it with the guidelines. The Sentencing Commission does not have that authority to do it with statutory provisions. So only Congress can do that. And Congress hasn't done it.
Interesting. Okay, so let me ask you this. And it's funny when you talk about that crack to powder disparity being dropped from 100-to-1 to 18-to-1. People act like that's you know, that's equality or that's fair. But really, we have to remember 18-to-1 means that a 5-year powder sentence still translates to a 90-year crack sentence for the same amount of the drug. So, Yeah. So it's still not even anywhere close. It's not even in the neighborhood of equitable. It's just less horrible than what we had before. One of the things you said on Facebook that got my attention, and I appreciated the fact that you brought this up with the president making his visit this week to a facility. You said that, you know, a lot of, and this is expected, right, that you said that a lot of what the president would see would be cleaned up. It would be kind of the powder puff version of what it's like to actually be locked away. And the reason, one of the reasons I definitely wanted to talk to you was because I want the real deal. I want people to know what it's really like behind those walls. When you wrote that post about the president and not being able to see what it's really like in those facilities, what were you thinking about, and what is it really like in those facilities so people can just kind of know?
Well, what the president is going to actually see, he's going to see the cleanup version of El Reno. During my 20 years in federal prison, I had participated in a lot of these high-profile visits. I would assume that he's not going to be able to mingle with the prisoners. The prisoners are going to be handpicked that he will talk to based upon their record and their relationships with staff members. He's not going to get to go into the cells and see the way they live. And he's not going to get to see the real treatment that they receive. The way that the correctional officials talk, treat, and the most important aspect is of what he will not see is the sentencing processing aspect that goes with the case management of the cases, or better yet, the prisoners, how they are processed into different levels of minimum, medium, and high or maximum. It's very important because most of the black prisoners, African-American prisoners, are sent to high security penitentiaries. And that has something to do with the crack law.
Interesting.
No, in the high security penitentiaries, that's where a lot of prisoners lose their lives. There's a lot of violence there and a lot of murders there. And that's where mostly African American prisoners are serving their time.
Interesting. So even within the system, you've observed a clear racial disparity in terms of what happens to black inmates versus inmates of other ethnicities, correct?
Yes, the system is premised on racial tone. Black inmates eat with black inmates, white inmates eat with white inmates. They have their area, and you're not to violate anyone's area. You know, when they go over here to eat, you cannot go over there and sit. Even if you go in the chow hall and there's no seats available, and you see one in the white area, you better not go over there. And it goes the same for any other racial aspect of the prison system.
One thing I, if I'm not mistaken, I think that you had said this to me once. And if you didn't, I apologize. But I want to go back on this because it might have been a couple years ago. You might have said this to me. You mentioned that one of the difficult stipulations to overcome is this idea of having perfect behavior during your time that you're away, because there are so many threats. So many things that can happen. Sometimes you may not be looking for the trouble, but the trouble may come to you. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
That's funny because I made a note of that this morning when I was thinking about the commutation of sentences that the president is handing out. If you get in a fight, which is common, when I was in a penitentiary, my case manager told me that it is expected to have some sort of violence on your record in a penitentiary because of the environment that you live in. You may have to protect yourself. Or whatever the situation is, there's violence, and most inmates are going to have some violence on their record. And the policy of the new pardon commission, if you have violence, it precludes you from a commutation of sentence. But under the BOP's policy, a fight without a weapon is considered violence. Even if someone attacks you, and you're defending yourself in the fight, and you're found to have committed a prohibited act of fighting, that in itself is violence, and that is sufficient for the BOP to provide that information to President Obama to preclude prisoners from receiving a commutation of sentence. Because the prison sti the policy stipulates if there's violence before you went to prison, before a prisoner went to prison, or during the prisoner's term of incarceration. So if a fight occurred, that's violence. He or she is precluded from receiving a commutation of sentence, even if he meet all other criteria. He has an outstanding crack sentence that has been ruled unjustly.
So, you're put in this violent environment where you are around some pretty frightening people, and if someone attacks you and you defend yourself, then you will be defined as a violent person and therefore ineligible for commutation.
Correct.
Wow. Okay. Let me ask you this.
But see, most people won't pick up on that aspect. They won't because they don't know the BOP policy that precludes that fighting is considered violence.
I want to ask you this, man. We know that that there are some bad people that are locked away. We know that there are people that have done terrible things. And one of the things I've run into is the difficulty of helping people to understand that that just because someone's labeled a felon, that does not make them necessarily a bad person. There are cases where people made a mistake. There are people who were falsely incarcerated, but then there are people who deserve to be incarcerated because they did something terrible. How do you help people understand the variety of human beings that are locked away, and help them get away from this idea of putting everyone into one box. Because it seems to me that there are some people who think that when you talk about prison torture, when you talk about what happens when people are put in solitary, when you talk about some of the violence that occurs, they just say, well, you know what? If you didn't want that to happen to you, then you shouldn't have broke the law. How do you respond to people when they say things like that?
Well, I try to use myself as an example. I spent 20 years in prison. Immediately after I was released from prison, I enrolled in college. I obtained a bachelor's degree in criminal justice. Immediately after I obtained a bachelor's degree, I enrolled in a master's degree program. And in 6 weeks, I will complete that program. And I also petitioned a senior United States district judge to release me from a supervised release. And the court determined that my behavior was extraordinary and released me from supervised release more than 3 years earlier than required. So I try to use myself as an example. Of course, I sold drugs and I should have been punished. I was punished. And I rehabilitated myself, and I'm a changed person now. I think that most people understand, especially if they have someone that they are associated with or they have a family member in prison. It's easy for them to understand. But like you said, there's some people that can't understand that. But what I try to do is to get them to look at the inequality of the sentencing aspect. You know, all we want is equality. It's not a get out of jail and go free pass. You know, we just want equality. Equality, and that's something that is missing. President Obama recognized that. He spoke on that, on the inequality of the drug sentences.
You know, it seems to me that it is quite simple to, you know, for people to realize that the punishment has to fit the crime. That, you know, it's like if my daughter steals a piece of candy, and I decide I want to shoot my daughter in the leg, I can't just turn and say, well, if she didn't want to get shot in the leg, she shouldn't have stole candy, right? We agree that stealing candy is wrong, but the punishment has to fit the magnitude of the offense. And these drug sentences were so long, I mean, just so crazy that the punishment didn't fit the crime. And so I think it's important to make that distinction so people don't think that we're saying that everybody who goes away should be released, or that every person who goes away is a good person. One thing I want to hit on too, because I literally have two more things I want to ask you, because I know you're a busy man and I don't want to take too much of your time. But one thing I want to throw in here, and I want you to speak on this if you can. I know that you are an excellent ambassador for the individuals who are being affected by this system. Every interaction I've had with you, you're very super articulate, smarter than most of the professors I know. You know, even when people see you well dressed and you know, well spoken and everything else, that's what I've been seeing, you know, since I've known you. So I want to, but one thing I want to get make sure people know is you know, whether or not, or I know you're an exception. I know that you're unique, but tell me about some of the other guys that you knew when you were locked away, who could also go and make a positive contribution to society. That you're not just sort of the pink unicorn. You are the, you know, you're representative of a segment of that population of lost potential. Tell me about some of the guys that you remember, who, if they were out, would be doing great things for their community.
I don't think I'm unique. I think that I'm a reflection of the majority of the federal prisoners that are serving drug sentences. I believe that they would get out and do the same thing that I'm doing. While we were in prison, we didn't have access to college education in most institutions. I was able to obtain a college education in part because of my family paid for it, not because the prison system paid for it. There are a lot of prisoners, they can't get that access. They don't have the access that I had. But I'm sure that most of them would come out of prison and they would succeed. They would do what I'm doing. The majority of them would search for education if they could, or find employment. They're not unique. I mean, I'm not unique. They're more similar to me than most people would think.
All right. Well, I love hearing that. I love hearing the real story here. And I want to ask you this. I don't have a I don't think I ever got a chance to ask you if you had any children before you went away.
Yes, I have a son. When I went to prison, I think he was a little over, he was about 18 months when I went to prison. And he's a nice young man now, I must say that.
So, here you were. You were a 26-year-old man, clearly very intelligent. I mean, I'm sure you probably taught your lawyer a thing or two when you were fighting for your release. You had an 18-month-old son, and when the judge was sentencing you, did he or she make any acknowledgement whatsoever of the children or the child you would leave behind, the family you would be leaving behind? Was there any conversation about that, or was it just a matter of sending you away and that's it?
It was basically about getting me off the face of the earth. That's what it was about. The judge that released me from prison is not the same judge that sent me to prison. The judge that sent me to prison, it's my opinion that if the judge was still over my case when it was time for me to be released, I would still be in prison today.
So when the judge gave you 37 and a half years in prison with no parole for selling 1 gram of crack cocaine, he wasn't just sentencing you. He was sentencing your wife to 37 and a half years without a husband, your mother to 37 and a half years without a son, and your son to 37 and a half years without a father. So a whole family was affected, not just one person. Accurate.
Exactly. But those are factors that the judge could have taken into consideration. The court could have departed from the guidelines based upon those factors.
Interesting. Well, I want to end this conversation on an optimistic note. Now you're home. You're doing amazing things. I see you. You just, I mean, every time I check on you on Facebook, you're updating with some great accomplishment that you've recently achieved. What's next for you and your family?
Well, I'll be so glad when I don't have to do any homework anymore. I was up late last night doing homework, and I talked to you while I was in Miami. And what was in the forefront of my mind is that I had a bunch of assignments to turn in. Although I went down there to enjoy myself, I still had an objective to accomplish my schoolwork. So it'll be grateful when I don't have to write research papers. But then again, my wife tell me, she said that I'm going to miss it. I think she actually wants a doctor in the house.
Well, little does she know, she already has one. You already have more education than most of the people I know who spent a lot of years in school. And you are a great example of people who use their time in a really effective and productive way. And I think it's important for people to know that as you mentioned, you're not the only one. There are a whole lot of individuals that are left behind whose sentences should be reviewed so that we can create a more fair and equitable situation. And I want to say, oh, go ahead. Did I cut you off?
And I would say to President Obama, let's give these prisoners a chance. 10 years is sufficient. 10 years is one of the requirements for the commutation. 10 years is sufficient. The criteria should be somewhat flexible. If they were to be considered under the circumstances that I was considered, the judge would have some flexibility, some discretion in the matter. The criteria as it exists for commutations is not flexible. So let's have some flexibility, some discretion in the criteria, and pick up the pace. We need to release more of these prisoners. There are a lot of prisoners serving mandatory life sentences, and some of them have died, and some of them will continue to die before this process is over. Let's get them out.
All right. That was a very fitting finish to the conversation. And I want to say thank you so much for sharing your story, man. I really, really appreciate this.
Thank you. We must do it again.
We certainly will, man. We certainly will. All right, everybody. This is Mr. Darrell Padgett. Darrell Padgett, he was sentenced to 37 and a half years for possession of 1 gram of crack cocaine. He has become an upstanding citizen, and he's just somebody I think you should look into and get to know. By the way, Daryl, do you have anything public that where people can reach out to you and talk to you?
Yeah, I have a website, insighttoprisonconsultant.com. I'm very active on my Facebook page. They also can go to my website and send me emails from my website,
Okay.
or they can contact me on Facebook.
Repeat the name of that website again.
Insightintoprisonconsultant.com.
Okay, insight into prison consultant.com.
Consultant.com.
Got you. Okay, I'm gonna make sure I share that website so people can connect with you. All right, but thank you very much, brother. I appreciate this.
Thank you.
Absolutely. All right, everybody, this is Mr. Daryl Padgett at insightintoprisonconsultant.com. I hope that you will visit his website, send him a note of support. Make sure you understand you're a soldier in this battle. You're not. There are no bystanders in any of this. Mass incarceration is the most important civil rights issue in our society today. It's been clearly decided that mass incarceration has not worked for America, that the war on drugs has not worked for America. Now it's a matter of helping our leaders have the political will to make these adjustments that are necessary to create a better society. And me, I'm Dr. Boyce Watkins from Your Black World. And until we meet again, please stay strong, be blessed, and be educated. We are gone. Peace.